So what Roy said before, bring up his website, roy.ac2gs.com. There's five pictures on there. You know, five pictures that I thought would be interesting. Of course, a lot of this is being put on the news, but the details of it sometimes are not really making it to the general news. Bush could eventually find some of the stuff on the internet, so I naturally find that. Quite a thing that I think are not that common. Anyway, the overall mission for Artemis, they call it, the Space Launch System, launched this thing from 39B in Florida. Launch Complex 39B. 39A has been taken over by SpaceX, but when the shuttles were going off there, we had two launch complexes. And had two launch complexes for the Saturn V, for the Saturn mission. And it's the same with this. So they turned over Launch Complex 39A to a private company. 39B is still active for NASA. So this has nothing to do with private companies. It's behind schedule. I mean, they did try to launch, try to get this thing off the ground in 2017, but delays, a lot of testing, and then they've got it to the point where they have to launch this vehicle 8.8 million pounds of thrust, roughly 15% more thrust than Saturn V rocket, and they have like 7.5 million pounds of thrust. So bigger rocket, and as the years go on, this thing's going to grow. It's actually going to grow in height by about 40 feet, and it's going to get more powerful. But now, it's going to be the most powerful manned rocket that has ever been launched into space. Right now, it's unmanned. If all goes well at the end of this 42-day mission, they plan on putting a crew in here, four people, in about a year and a half. And that will be called Artemis 2. And they plan on doing the same thing, going to the moon, past the moon, and eventually coming back and landing in the Pacific Ocean. And then, if that mission goes well, they figure about a year after that, probably 2025, they plan on actually sending another crew there and actually sending two people down to the moon, actually landing on the moon. But, you know, first steps are most important. And of course, he's going to check out the rocket itself, which has never been launched. If you look at the bottom of the rocket, website. The first page has actually a picture of the Artemis moon rocket. The very bottom has the four RS-25 engines. They're liquid fuel engines. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. From the shuttle days, back to the collection of four engines, they've actually flown on about 25 shuttle missions. So they've been used before. Of course, they've been refurbished and pushed to the limit too. They now run at 109% efficiency. Much more thrust than the original. And then they run with two solid boosters that are attached. They're built by Northrop Grumman. Each one of them is going to push over 3.5 million pounds of thrust collectively between the liquid fuel engines, four of them, and the two boosters. You get the 8.8 million pounds of thrust. And that'll take off within 2 minutes. All the fuel will be gone in the booster. Remember the shuttle days, boosters separate from the main external tank. And it was land in the ocean, and they actually refurbish them. They're not doing that anymore. They're not going to refurbish these. First stage, liquid core will continue to of it was four old shell engines, and they'll continue for about a little over 8 minutes until they get to around 52 miles high, which is sufficient space, and that stage will separate from the next stage, second stage. They call that the interim cryogenic propulsion stage. And that's the one that's going to be pushing 25,000 pounds of thrust, and that will be the one that actually pushes it through TLI, that's trans-lunar injection. That will revert orbit and send it on the way to the moon. Now above that they have the European Space Agency service module. Service module is going to have the fuel and the engine to operate Orion in lunar orbit. Will actually be able to push spacecraft Orion back to Earth when needed, so it can relight many times. And that's provided by the European Space Agency. It has four panels that open up, four solar panels that will open up to supply, around 12 kilowatts of power to the system. That will also, in the future, supply water for the crew and oxygen and everything that the crew needs. On top of that is the Orion spacecraft, and if you go down to the next picture, you see the exploded view of this. The service module followed by the Orion spacecraft, and then on top of that is the launch abort system, which is hopefully not needed, but it's attached to the spacecraft. You had a crew in there, and they needed to abort. That thing would really come into play. You see, there's three sets of rockets, solid engines on it, and it's a launch port. Rockets, they're the bigger ones. This problem that would pull the whole Orion spacecraft away from the service module, it would, fly through the atmosphere, and then it would eventually land in the ocean. Atlantic Ocean and be recovered. A launch abort system. The first three sets that hopefully would never be used. The next set above it is called the jettison motors. They will be used. They'll be used in this flight. Once they get into space, you don't need launch abort system anymore. Those will ignite, and it will pull the launch abort system away from Orion, leaving Orion attached to the service module, continue on the twist. And then above that, you have these attitude control rockets. They're needed when if there wasn't launch abort, the crew. What would happen is the crew would have to be in the right attitude for the parachutes to open up to bring them safely down. You don't want to be upside down and have the parachutes open up at that time. So that's what those motors are used for. You can see three bearings that are going to be separated during launch. Those things have to come off smoothly because that's going to expose the solar panels. Orion, remember in the Apollo days, they didn't have solar panels. They had fuel cells in there, but they didn't have any solar panels. They didn't have this problem. So you need to protect the solar panels during launch. All the things will separate. What it will look like would be the next picture down below, below that exploded view. You can see the four panels sticking out. They part of the European Space Agency service module. Now, even that design comes from European Space Agency's sent cargo up to the International Space Station, and they pulled in the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle. They sent five of these things up over many years, roughly one a year or so. And they were so successful that NASA said, hey, you know, you guys should design our service launch. And that's where this came from. The original designs, they had the ground control panels, I think, where they went with the original ones that they used to use for the ATV, automatic transit vehicle, ISS. That picture you can see was where the crew would be. They have three mannequins in the Orion spacecraft. This light up the one up on top, he's the main mannequin. They put him in a regular space suit. Same thing as this, what an astronaut would wear. They're going to do pressure tests, they're going to do radiation tests, they're going to do a thermal test, vibration test on that. As well as smaller mannequins below of that. Small ones don't have any feet or any arms or anything. They just torsos. And they have one with radiation chest protecting them. And then the other one doesn't have the chest protector. So they're going to do an A-B test with that. And, there's five pictures. This is the fourth one, which I still find interesting. Since they're going to the moon, they're going to use it for launching CubeSats. Not in Earth orbit, but, some of them are going to go into lunar orbit, or some of them are going to go into solar orbit, the heliocentric orbit. And there's 10 of them on board. And that's located in the terrain, right above the midterm cryogenic propulsion. Now, once that stage, essentially this is the next stage after the fourth stage is gone, once that stage has done its job, push the Orion and European Space Agency service module on the way to the moon, they don't need that anymore. So it's done its job. Those CubeSats will not interfere with the flight itself, so they have that space. Let's put a CubeSat on there, and they plan on doing a lot of flying from those things as well. And of course, below that is I put another picture of what it looks like now. They had a picture on the internet with the space launch system, mobile launch platform, big lightning tower surrounding it, the water tower in the background, and then they, sure enough, their destination, the moon was in the right spot for a great picture. So that's the overview. It's going to take 42 days to get there. They're going to be back eventually 25,000 miles an hour on a return trip. By the time they get to the Earth, that's the speed they'll be going. And they want to test this almost 16-foot diameter. Diameter heat shield. They want to test that. They've done numerous tests on that. Now they really want to give it a good test. Duplicate that speed. You can't really do that in a wind tunnel. And temperatures should get around 5,000 degrees. Of course, that all has to go well. And the 11 sets of parachutes that will have to eventually come out. I mean, one of the three big ones, but it's going to be drogue chutes and other things that take place to safely get a crew back to the Pacific. Hopefully, this all goes well. Coming back on October 10th. I'll talk about that at the time, I'm sure. Hopefully, we can get off the ground. Any comments, questions? This is WS2N, the early part of the space network report for the tech network. Nothing heard, but everybody, thanks for listening. I'll be back regular time later in the net. Like Rory said, talk more about the space launch system. Stop fueling it tonight at 12 o'clock, and tomorrow morning, it's your launch day. in there. Should be pretty exciting. Anyway, we'll give a shout back to you, Roy, ATGS, WS2N.
AP2GS, thank you very much, Paul. That was an interesting discussion, and I look forward to the second part later tonight of the space network. Once again, I'm AP2GS, named Roy. This is a lot more technical net. We're part of the night where we try and discuss technical concepts, preferably the first two questions. That's to be radio related. That's what we're all about here. But we'll open the way to any kind of technical discussion with science. We'll even touch upon medicine if people are really curious or interested. Once again, we do not treat nor diagnose over the radio, but we can have general discussions on the subject. So, with all that in mind, if there's anyone out there who either has a statement, a comment, a return on a question that experiments that they've worked on and would like to share with us, or technical questions, please hit that push to talk button with your first name and your call sign. I think we have another quiet August night, but thankfully this is the last Sunday in August, so next week will be Labor Day, and hopefully there'll be more activities as far as questions and such. So let's try it one more time. If there's anyone out there with any questions or comments to make, technical nature, please hit that push and talk button, give us your first name, and call them. Yes, chat recognized. You're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Okay, maybe there'll be some latecomers. Chat, what's your comment or your question for tonight?
All right, well, I just had a suspicion last weekend. I'm busy, but I have friends. That's really good for me because I oversleep, I fall asleep, I gotta get up early. I listened to the station report earlier, was a boon to me. Really enjoyed it, having that earlier. First thing. The second thing is, this is kind of like out of left field type of thing, but I'd like to say that maybe somebody knows somebody. I have a buddy up in Canada, New Brunswick province, who fixes amateur radio equipment of any kind, absolutely any kind. I probably remember he's in Canada. I wanted to know if anybody knows a trucker, I call it a gypsy trucker that goes to New Brunswick on a regular basis so that we could get some rigs up to this guy who actually fixes like 20 rigs a week. It's unbelievable. He wrote to the chief engineer of the guy in New Brunswick area there, TV and radio. So if anybody knows a gypsy tractor trailer guy that basically goes up to New Brunswick harbor, willing to carry some radio for repair back and forth, please let me know. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Chet. So you guys out there, if you know any truckers who make runs to New Brunswick, Chet is on URZ. His email address is readily available. So keep it in mind and spread the news. Maybe no one listening tonight knows of the trucker, but maybe someone knows someone who knows the trucker that goes to New Brunswick. So please keep that in mind, file it away in your head, and see what we come up with. And then I have we'll be back later tonight for the rest of the SpaceNet report. And if you ever feel that you have to visit, you never really have to visit, because actually we have Mike AP2NJI. He records it on days that he can't record it. I record it and send it to him. So if you go to the archive site, we pretty much have an uninterrupted record of
Senate report, the whole text that's available to you going back years and years and years and years. Yes, Rich.
Now, nobody laugh at this, but, and it's a little bit of a reach, but believe it or not, a lot of hay for horses comes from Canada. And I know living out here on the North Fork of Long Island, a lot of people do business with these truckers that transport hay from Canada. And I'm sure, you know, if you do enough digging, there's a guy out there who wouldn't mind putting a couple of radios in the passenger seat on his back and forth to Canada. Don't know exactly where in Canada, but it's worth a shot if you run out of any and all other ideas. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, that's an idea. You know, the problem as I see it is how to kind of get in touch with these types of people. If you don't live in the area, it's very difficult to come up with a name or a phone number or anything like that. You know, it's a shame there's no kind of a forum where you can post things like that. Although, I would guess if you look hard enough, you might find forums. I don't know if trucker technology runs heavy with internet forums, but, you know, that might be an option. Google is always our friend.
Again, depending on how important it is, you could look up horse farms on the North Fork and call them, ask them if they get their hay from Canada, and could they give you a telephone number? That wouldn't be hard to do at all, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess so. Just it requires a little bit of a further effort on your part, Chet. But we gave you a couple of simple options, ideas, and hopefully there are other people listening tonight. If they have something that they don't want to mention on the radio for whatever reason, you're on QRZ, so it's very easy to get in touch with you. You want to give them your call sign one more time just to make sure that they memorize it?
Yes, sure. WB2AHK, Washington, Bravo 2, America, Hotel, Kilowatt. This guy is my personal friend. He started an amateur radio repair service, and he has stayed in only 6 months. He fixed 250 bricks for amateurs in Canada at a very, very reasonable price. Very reasonable price. This guy is so smart. He does things like I've never seen before. There's nothing he can't fix. And he does it as a sideline. Chief engineer of several TV stations and radio FM stations and AM stations up there. He goes everywhere in the New Brunswick area, and he keeps himself busy. I don't know how he gets the strength to do all these things, time-wise and, you know, stamina-wise. But, that'd be great. I actually will check out. That's a great idea. Horse farms with the hay. I like that idea. I will check that, because I have a linear amplifier I want to give him that's lying around here before I throw it in the garbage and needs repair. And I want to give it to him, but it takes heat up for me for free. And I don't want to pay customs and all this other stuff. And you don't know how expensive it is to ship something heavy like a linear amplifier that weighs 100 pounds. Now you're talking like $300 just one way to get it there. It's ridiculous. So thanks, Roy. I appreciate that. And maybe we can figure out a way to get on a regular basis rigs going back and forth that need repair. Okay, thank you very much. WB2 Alpha Hotel Killer.
Okay, good luck, Jeff. I hope it works out. I've told the story before that I have a rig expert and net analyzer, and I tend to like the rig experts. But they're kind of weird in that
It's kind of a small business, so apparently what they've done is their revere guy lives in Canada, right on the border. And if you have a broken rig expert under warranty, if you want it repaired by them, you send it to a P.O. box number in upstate New York, and this guy travels back and forth to the border, picks it up, takes it back to Canada, works on it, drives it back to upstate New York, and ships it back without having to deal with the nuisance that you mentioned. So it's a shame that he doesn't have a guy that kind of runs the border, but maybe you'll be able to set something up. So I wish you good luck, Jack. Once again, this is ACCS. This is the Limar Technical Net. If anyone out there has any questions or comments, please hit that push talk button and give us your first name and call. Okay. Slow night is going to be. Slow night is going to be. Let me try something a little different. I always say if you're going to steal from the best. I was listening, as I often do, to ABC-MD, who's on Echo Link. He dropped off of the just as I was mentioning his name. He might come back. You know, sometimes the Echo Link is a little flaky. Anyway, he has a Papa Network antenna set net every Friday night at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. It's the Papa Network, which is a big UHF, VHF network that runs on the West Coast. So I always like to listen to it. Last night, a person came on and was discussing an old Boogermeister, an old grandmother's tale, that you shouldn't coil up your coax cable because it will make it inductive and detune it and increase your viswap. And of course, a proper coax cable is capable of something like 90 decibels of isolation. It's a differential mode, so you can coil it up, and the differential mode is not going to see that inductance or that inductive reactance at all. What we'll see is if you have common mode currents running as reflected back from your antenna, which you really don't want most of the time. So that's why people use the ugly ballon, as they call it. It's just an air core coil, a coax cable that chokes RF to a degree. That's Dr. Beck.
QOGB Mobile just checking in.
Okay, great. I'll consider you checked in. So, they were kind of rolling that around, and someone discussed a problem that he saw, apparently. There's not a lot of details, so this is not really going to be a puzzle. This is not a true, full, correct answer, incorrect answer, but more something that hopefully you guys will discuss with me, and maybe we'll learn something from it. But he mentioned that some guy had a TV radio, I guess it was a mobile or something, and anyway, he decided to coil up his coax cable and noticed that the viswap was really bad when it was coiled up. And, he questioned the group there of why that should be the case, if in most cases coiling a coax doesn't have an effect one way or the other. So I'm curious, people out there listening tonight, do you have any good reasons why a coiled up coaxial cable could possibly fail in this way and give you a mismatched viswap?
Maybe does it have to do with signal-wise or like what you said, having more reflected power turned back into your radio?
Well, I mean, that's just, you're describing what a mismatch in a high standing wave ratio is, but the question is, if theoretically a coax could do that, why did this size coax need to do that?
Sounds very mysterious to me. Let's hear the answer.
like I said, there's no definitive answer because this wasn't a guy that had a puzzle or did an experiment and proved the thing. He just kind of mentioned it, and that's where it ended. So I thought it would be more of a general case discussion than a true-false type of thing. But, you know, I have my opinions, and I will certainly share them with everyone out there, but I would be curious and or interested if other people have either the same ideas that I had or even better ideas of why that should be the case for this guy, TV radio.
Oh, DBA for the company.
Yes, John.
It's possible that the coiling might have been disabled with an aggressive type small radio coiling. That would have caused this bump.
Yeah, that was the one that I had guessed. You know, I guess theoretically, if the shielding was incredibly bad, you could have something that was kind of iffy as far as differential mode currents running on it that might screw the coax phase up. But the most obvious possibility to me is if it's a relatively coaxial cable, one of the failure modes is you have to know what turning radius the coax cable will tolerate, because all coax cables have a dielectric insert between the center conductor and the outer shield. And if the material is too soft, and your turning angle is too sharp, you can have the center wire being off-center. As you push the center wire off-center, you're going to just be nominal impedance in that area, and you're going to have an impedance mismatch in areas where they don't necessarily have to short out, but they can be so off-center that their impedance is no longer close to 50 ohms, and you'll get reflected. So, yeah, that was my idea. That's primarily what was going bad was the turning radius sharp or the quality of the foam dielectric in the coax case.
Also, the deforming imbalance, the coiling, to restrict unbalanced current, it won't affect forward or reflective power. But it's for unbalanced.
Well, yeah, but I like to have the call as common mode because I think people have a better sense of what common mode is versus a differential mode. But yeah, you could use different terms for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a common mode.
I keep on mentioning eventually in the fall I'm going to drop a bunch of articles to the club newsletter, and one of them is a nice illustration of common mode and how common mode problems are somewhat dependent upon the length of the transmission line. There are transmission line length in relation to wavelength where it's not so much of a problem. I put it into an antenna simulation software, and you can sort of see where everything goes to hell if you don't use a common mode choke on many types of antennas. You can get away with some, but sometimes it's just the length of the transmission line that makes the difference between it reaching havoc in your shack and not. Anyway, that was my little puzzlet for the night. So always buy good quality coaxial cable. It always pays in the end. You know, you can save a couple of bucks up front, but usually it tends to be counterproductive. You know, places like Radio Shack are gone now, but in the old days, I remember sometimes the problem with Radio Shack is they didn't really make most of their own stuff. They just found the manufacturers and re-branded them. So sometimes Radio Shack OS cables were great when they were able to buy a lot from a good company. But I saw some Radio Shack OS cables that were awful, where you know, it wasn't a shield as much as was a random set of copper stranded wires on the outside. So let the buyer beware. I know everyone's trying to save a buck these days, so if it is to, you know, buy those inexpensive Chinese coaxial cables, yes, some of them are great, some of them probably are awful. Everyone keep that in mind. Nevertheless, hopefully, at this point, someone finally decided that they have a question or a topic for discussion tonight. So if that's the case, please hit that push the talk button. First name and your call sign.
82, OGB Mobile.
Okay, Craig, I assume that means you have a question or a topic for tonight.
Actually, it has to do with repeaters. Yes, I do. And I kind of need to make this a quick one, because I'm almost where I gotta be. But I don't have a problem leaving my engine running just to get the answer out of this one.
Okay, so what's the question?
Okay, so, when I was in Jamaica a couple nights ago, just waiting to clock out and go home, there were a couple of repeaters that I actually programmed in the area, and I had the tone and everything set right, but then when I key up, I'm not, like, hitting it, or, like, it might be set up so I actually have to speak in order to actually set off the ID for the repeater. Is that maybe the case, or maybe is the repeater just offline, or I just might not have the repeater programmed in correctly?
Well, it's difficult to say. Unfortunately, some repeaters are kind of turned off without any notice for receipt. Sometimes it's they're linked to other repeaters in a one-way condition, and there's no notification. So I have heard linked repeaters where they seem active, so you hear transmission, but they're not set up for one reason or another to receive from that particular repeater. They're just programmed at the time to simply relay communication from another repeater through IRLP or some other linking method. Or it could be that your PL phone was incorrect, or set incorrect. If you got a acknowledge, that would mean that the PL phone was correct. If you didn't get an acknowledge, that would kind of indicate to me that the PL phone would go off. So I'm not really familiar with repeaters that are designed to act as a box on top of the PL phone. I would assume that they'll take the PL phone as an indication that someone's trying to transmit and trigger the usual linking circuit. So I can't tell you exactly why this particular repeater failed to respond to you. It could have been that it was off, it could have been the PL phone was set wrong, or it could be that you were just far enough away from it that it couldn't capture your signal. So it couldn't detect the proper PL phone to acknowledge you. Anyone else have any good ideas, please feel free.
Okay, could you say Ed?
Yes, Ed.
Not all repeaters that I've listened to have the 600 offset. There's one that's very interesting, has a 1 megacycle offset over.
That is quite true. You can have the offset wrong. About a year ago, I was talking on this repeater, and someone asked me about a 1 megahertz offset, and that was the old KC2RA. King County Repeater Association repeater had a 1 megahertz non-standard offset.
Now, I went through repeater book and I double checked everything. Now, depending on the radio you also program it with, that could also be important because some repeaters only have one tone, like a transmitting tone, but the way how I did it was, for example, with the Bofeng or Radio Diddy radio that I actually just picked up, what I did was I put in the receive frequency, but then I set the transmitting tone on the receive frequency, not the transmitting frequency, and then the transmitting frequency I just program in itself, and then usually it sometimes works, but there are repeaters out there that actually have both tones that you have to set the receiving tone and the transmitting tone as if you were transmitting and receiving using CT.
Okay, that sounds complicated. The way that I would kind of simplify it, it might not be exactly what you said, so forgive me this. A lot of repeaters will have a swell tone. So in addition to a PL tone to trigger the repeater transmitter, the repeater will transmit with its own PL tone to break swell, so that people who have their radios set to break swell with their PL tone can utilize that. That's generally not terribly useful, except nowadays people have digital radios. So if you have don't have a digital radio, but you're talking to a station that can go from digital to analog, and you don't want to hear the digital noise, you can put a PL squelch tone so that when it's in analog mode, it'll give the PL tone to break the squelch. In digital mode, it won't give the PL tone and won't break the squelch. Now, most repeaters are set for the squelch tone to be identical to the received PL tone on the repeater. I believe Limark didn't do that because it interfered with some aspects of the repeater. So I think the Limark has a different PL tone in the receiver and 12 tone in the transmitter. So that's a possibility as well. So you got to play around with, I guess, the PL tone. If you think that you're getting into the repeater, if you think that all the information is correct, then you just have to kind of play games with the PL tone. Now, just because it's in the repeater handbook doesn't necessarily mean it's accurate. Occasionally, errors do proceed to these booklets, and it's very difficult to correct them because things work on inertia with repeaters.
I have the tone for. For example, the mostly where it's only one tone, the transmitting tone, does it really matter if I have it on the receive frequency or transmitting frequency if it's just one tone?
It depends on your radio because a lot of radios that I program specifically if they have the ability to have a receiver as well as tone, usually indicate that. So it's not usually a case of just using the tone and the value in the receive and the offset. It's usually indicated in a somewhat more useful way with the plug-in such that I've used in the past. And to argue, you want to make a comment?
Radio on, you know, doesn't matter.
That happens to me as well. So, Frank, well, anyone else out there with any words of wisdom for Frank?
Right now I'm on W2KPQ, and I have the tone just set to tone. There's two more modes. You have CP, and then you have DCS, which I don't think, I don't really know how that truly works, but some hear the repeater identify. They just want to be able to talk on it and still be able to hear other people talk to them, but just without the repeater identifying.
Well, you are best to keep it on the tone setting, because the tone will give you the standard old Motorola PL private line choice of tone. The others are a little bit more esoteric. There were people out there who thought that PL tones were too easy, and they wanted to make sure that it would be a little bit more difficult, and so they used digital signals to handshake with repeaters. But I don't know of anyone that uses them personally. So just keep it in tone. But still can't come up with any other great ideas. But again, if anyone else out there has any bright ideas, please share. Okay, very good. Look.
Hi, BRK. Thanks, Roy. Easy to GS Net Control, KD2OGB Mobile.
Okay. One thing that Greg has suggested was that the repeater might require and it was not that that was done. I don't know of any right now, but it was done to avoid chunking.
That's interesting. I wasn't aware. I thought that it, that would be kind of increasingly difficult once you add the PL tone to the equation. That would have probably been very useful with the history of Glen Oaks repeater. My understanding was one of the reasons why we went from only Sunday night turning the repeater off after midnight to turning it off every day, night of the week, was because there was a period fellow doing something in the middle of the night, and this was thought to be the easiest way of getting rid of that problem. Come back and tell us what you've discovered.
Hello, this is KD2ZYM. This is my first transmission. Thank you guys for doing this. Really interesting stuff. If you have any recommendations for a new user like myself, my name is Ari, and nice to meet you all.
Welcome, Ari. Welcome to the gang, and welcome to the Weimar Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. as an opportunity to learn from each other. So is there anything in particular question that is on the top of your mind tonight?
Not exactly. Just any technical advice to get started on a regular handheld transceiver here, and how do I connect up to other repeaters and talk to people in general?
Okay, very good. I'm just a little curious. So would that handy talk to be a Alpha or is it a different model?
I actually have an Anytone. It's a DMR capable. Looks kind of cool, so I got it. I also do have a Baofeng. I have a UDR as well.
Okay, is that a 676 or a 686?
I think the 878 UFUP, whatever the latest model was.
Okay, yeah, I have the 878, the earlier model. I like it. It's a nice, solid radio, even though it is a Chinese radio. The Baofeng, as you know, is much lighter. I laughingly call my Baofeng my disposable radio. If I drop it into the river, I'm not going to cry a great deal. The entire radio is less expensive than a tape that I bought for one of my more expensive handy talkies. But a handy talkie is a great initial purchase. I started with a handy talkie and progressed to a bunch of base stations and such. You have a UHF, VHF radio. Either contact, direct contact with different people on the VHF frequency of the 146.520 is the calling frequency for simplex. So theoretically, you can listen in on 520, and if you hear someone, you can respond directly. Otherwise, there are repeaters around, as we discussed this in the past. Problem with repeater books is that repeater books have a larger listing than the active repeaters in the area, because what they end up doing is recording the last 20 years of active repeaters. And sometimes repeaters are retired, sometimes repeaters are broken and never fixed, and a lot of times people don't kind of hover around certain receivers, so you could actively conjunct it, you could call into it, but very few people tend to listen to it unless they have it on a rotating scanner.
Drop.
Yes, Ed.
If we're discussing education, I think she's not aware of the rule about the furniture. I think it might be a good time for a little less on that.
Okay. What Ed is discussing is it's very important to pause when you unkey. When the other person unkeys, don't switch keys back. It's kind of an impulse and a reflex action that we all have to fight against. You want to have the repeater reset, and you also want to have a little bit of a pause so that if someone else has a brilliant idea that they'd like to share, they have an opportunity to do it. Especially with our technical nets, because we also have something called EchoLink, which I would suggest that you Google and look into, because it's a very useful thing that you now have access to since you have a license. And they have a longer lag time to respond. So if people quit key to the repeater during these nets, they're left to just listen and they can't respond. So that's a very good lesson that Ed suggested. The courtesy belt. Let the carrier drop and give people time to respond. Don't quickly switch back to either answer the question or ask a new question, although we all kind of have that impulse.
Understood. I just waited for the tone right there. So thank you very much for that and for the 146.520. That's great advice for first listening. Thank you. Great job you guys are doing.
Well, thank you. Once again, Google EchoLink and get access to it. This will allow you to plug in digitally on any kind of internet access to both local repeaters. Our repeater is linked via EchoLink. There are other local repeaters that are linked by EchoLink, but there are repeaters all throughout the world that are also linked through EchoLink. So you can chat with repeaters on the West Coast using a cell phone or a PC and such. So I would certainly look into the EchoLink. Now, with repeater lists, when I first got a license, it was very difficult for me to figure out what the active repeaters were and weren't, because no one really had a useful article to describe them. Everyone would sort of just ramble on and give you a list in their head, or else they would tell you to get the repeater book, again, which will give you...